It is time for the Media Beat. We get together with David Taracek on a Friday morning, and we take a look at the media, how the media covers, what it covers, and the stories that they're covering. And I want to start off today, David, with a quote from an anchor on years gone by. He didn't necessarily make this quote as an anchor, but he made this quote as an individual. War itself, of course, a form of madness. It's hardly a civilized pursuit. It's amazing how we spend so much time inventing devices to kill each other and so little time working on how to achieve peace. That was a quote made by Walter Cronkite after that was, I do believe, right after he did that live special, not live, but when he was in Vietnam. And David, it's almost like we're thrown back in time with, once again, history repeating itself. It seems like we as human beings just can't learn the lesson.
Well, to take another quote from old Uncle Walter, as he was known at CBS, where I worked for a while, he would always end his broadcast with, "That's the way it is." And I'm afraid, you know, it's hard not to take a somewhat sardonic tone, if not being sarcastic, just to say that does seem to be the way it is. It's not as if we learn very much from our histories. We're in a state of war. We're not a participant, an active participant, this country, but it's clearly a war that is dominating the world, certainly catching the entire world's attention. And it's war, just as the most dire predictions in the past few weeks, as we've been discussing, just as they've been forecasting. It's a full-scale invasion of Ukraine by air, land, and sea. It's aimed at the capital, as well as the already disputed and actually long fought over eastern areas of the country. And as you were reflecting on our history, as with any full-scale war, the job of truth-seeking journalism becomes that much harder to do by great multiples, I'd say. To the obvious fog of war is added the fog of contending propaganda efforts, of course. I was kind of touched to hear last night a very weary BBC reporter say, as the day was ending in Kyiv, his day had been, when he was asked how his day was, he said it's been long and confusing. A classic bit of British understatement by a British reporter there. I mean, amid all the ceaseless and inevitable propagandizing, including, I should add, Russia's flinging of totally unsupported accusations about what they're labeling now Nazi activity in that eastern area of Ukraine, there are many resonances with Europe's violent past century, or even past centuries, plural, if you take account of Putin's supposed arguments for his action, this military operation, as he describes it as, full-scale war, as the rest of the world's calling it, when observers were finding fault with the robustness or otherwise in the West's efforts to deter President Putin from launching this attack, there was a lot of evoking of the memory of efforts in the 1930s, you remember, to appease, that was the word of the time, the real Nazis under Hitler, ahead of World War II breaking out. And you'll remember that the leader, the British leader then, who was most associated with appeasement of Hitler, was the English Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, who flew to meet Hitler famously in Munich in 1938 to get his signature on a piece of paper that promised peace. You know, we know how successful that was. The specific threat likely to trigger war then was, of course, Czechoslovakia. And Chamberlain, speaking to his own people, called it, and I just dredged this quote up because it seems so redolent now, a quarrel in a faraway country between people of whom we know nothing. And that very unfortunate phrase just about sums up the problem for policymakers in the West, obviously, today, but also a problem for the media then and today, when the country at stake is, of course, Ukraine. When hostilities break out and are in full throttle, as they are now, It's the point when news outlets are even more limited than ever in the sources that they can access, and the propaganda on all sides ramps up, as I say, and to acknowledge the truth behind Chamberlain's unfortunate phrase is that the existing bedrock of understanding or lack of it among our audiences offers almost nothing to build upon, and so I'm sorry to repeat again, but here once more is an occasion for the hoary old truism. And remember that the one reliable thing about truisms is that they are true, or at least contain truth. And this truism is about truth itself. It's often said that the first casualty of war is truth, and that certainly that presents the big problem for journalists trying to get a hold of this story, and for the editors back at base to interpret it in full and in the round for the benefit of us consumers of news.
You know, looking at the weeks leading up to this, I guess the one thing that comes out of this, at least our intelligence agency got it right. And I think it was part of a plan of the president and the intelligence agency to put out what they knew. I think it was part of a plan maybe to put some doubt in Putin's head, but he's a different leader now than he was, I'll say 6 years ago, of Vladimir Putin, much more aggressive, and he really wants to reassemble the USSR.
Well, maybe going even further back in history than that, the Russian Empire before the Soviet Empire, the Tsarist Empire. That's one argument that is hard to dispute when you read very carefully his very closely argued. Although I wouldn't say that the logic is all that easy to follow at times, but he's certainly got a view of Russia's place in the world, which is at odds with what I think many Russians themselves regarded him as presenting when he took over. He's been in power now effectively for 22 years. And to use an old Scottish word, he's the kind of politician that the Scots would have described as canny, very pragmatic and very intentional in everything he did, and a great assessor of risks. It seems now that he's gotten to the point, I suppose, that he's neutralized so much internal opposition now that he's in a position, and indeed perhaps cowed his immediate neighbors, internationally speaking, at least immediately around his neighborhood, that he can take bigger risks that he would not have done in previous years. And it's arguable, at least, that he's gotten very bellicose in a way that is that would seem to people who knew him before, and many of them say this, that it's out of character. But it is. I mean, it's taken its inevitable course. I mean, he's been very consistent in all his threats and his statements of complaint, which of course is what is all, well, almost every speech of his is, a kind of litany of feeling victimized. Russia as a kind of victim in this situation, with NATO extending its influence eastward and being a threat to Russia. Now, Russia in this very unequal conflict with the much weaker country of Ukraine doesn't exactly look like a victim here, and I think he knows that. And at some point, he's going to have to react to one undoubted aspect of this operation of his, is that just about the entire world is rising up in reaction against it. He hasn't got a single solid supportive country backing him in this, apart from, you know, the client states that he has clasped to his bosom. Even China, who's been, you know, he went to China for the Olympics, one of the very few leaders who did, and that seemed to be a chummy kind of relationship. But even China is, while staying on Russia's side in the Security Council of the United Nations yesterday, is nonetheless adding a sort of provisional note to it all, and not sounding at all enthusiastic in its support for Russia.
And you just take a look at NATO, and a year or two ago, under a different president, the president, the administration, the Senate, the House, and a lot of people thought that NATO was out of date. Well, I think one of the things that happened that I don't think Putin expected was how NATO has come together strongly under an American president that that appreciates NATO. And NATO is no longer something that's not needed. It obviously NATO is needed very, very much so.
Well, yes, and it has verbally, at least, put up a very solid wall of opposition to what Putin has been planning. Now, it hasn't been enough to deter him crossing the borders and launching the artillery strikes and airstrikes too against Ukraine. On the other hand, it may make him pause about how far he can go. I mean, these are tactical questions where it's very hard to get a handle on. The amount of rock solid opposition that he's encountered, at least in that realm of public position taking that's been going on, we can only wait and see. But it stands a fair chance of at least limiting what he regards as his room for maneuver. But at the moment, what we're confronted with is an international scene repeated in the media outlets of just about every country where it's Russia on its own. The Ukraine is getting massive expressions of support. And of course, while diplomacy in general is supplanted by the exertion of brute force, nonetheless, diplomatic channels are still operating in a way, and some new diplomatic channels in a sense. Diplomatic channels are being defined differently anyway. The Twitter feed is an essential tool, for instance. Ukraine's foreign minister, Dmytro Kuleba, has been using Twitter as a feed for a continuous barrage of information to the rest of the world and high octanes for international help. And when you talk about what Putin might be encountering, here's what the Ukrainian diplomatic effort is seeming to be aimed at. I mean, it's a very consistent and somewhat simple message. I mean, Kuleba is saying, stop the war. It's his message to the United Nations Security Council, especially, and to the EU. He's saying impose severe economic sanctions against Putin and the Russian business sector, including banning it from the world banking system. But notably, and since the Ukrainians in general, and certainly the foreign minister is a realistic political leader, he's not saying to the West, come in and help us with military aid, not in the form of boots on the ground, at least, though obviously he wants more military materiel sent to his country and the buildup of a credible military threat against Moscow from the allied nations of NATO. That's what they're doing, as you say, when they present that solid flank. Though it's hard to see that having a lot of immediate deterrent effect on Putin, but he's on that roll. As I say, there's an autocratic swagger to his threatening now, and he couldn't fail to remind us in that pre-recorded video message of his that Russia is a powerful nuclear state. So what's being called for is what Biden, certainly in his very much even tougher, I guess, statement to the nation yesterday, what he's presenting is what he calls crushing sanctions. The United States certainly has been galvanized by this actual breakout of hostilities to cut off Russia's largest banks and companies from the Western financial markets, and it will restrict exports of technology to Russia. And the aim is clearly to vastly degrade the country's ability to thrive in the weeks and months and years ahead, I guess. And that's another acknowledgement of reality, if you like. These sanctions have one huge and obvious difference from, for instance, a series of missile strikes. They take time to exert an effect, which is why I was careful to stress weeks, years, and months a moment ago. Actually, the ultimate effect could be massively greater. And of course, again, in the realm of reason, of realism, there are costs too to consumers in the West, especially American consumers, where huge energy consumers, after all, and world prices for oil are rocketing. That's inevitable since Russia is among the world's three biggest oil suppliers. It's a complicated picture that's in play here, and striking an effectively opposing stance to Putin is not easy.
You know, you look back in time and you look at the United States and the 70 other countries that, when Iraq invaded a border country, took the time, formed really a global response to Iraq. And once Iraq was defeated, once again, people were calling us to go to Baghdad, and our Schwarzkopf said, no, we've completed our mission. But then we, of course, went into Afghanistan. We went into, of course, Iraq later, and for regime change. You take Russia. They went into Afghanistan for regime change. They, of course, went into Georgia right away. It seems that no big country seems to learn from their lessons and their failures and the deaths that mount with it, not only with military personnel, but civilians.
Well, yes. And the question has to be raised on the Russian side, what Russia actively and in real terms hopes to get out of this. The powerful phrase from the Ukrainian president is that Putin is attempting to tear up the map of Europe, the map that has been established since 1945 at the end of World War II. Now, whether the aim of achieving regime change is what Putin is after in Ukraine is a little unclear, but some predictions are pretty dire. The Pentagon itself is making it clear that one clear intent at play here Putin's forces may not pull it off, but it is to decapitate the government of Ukraine and, of course, establish another kind of client state for Putin. Now, that's maybe the aim, but as you say, big countries rolling into little countries and attempting regime change have not actually played out very well as a plan for big aggressive countries in previous times in the last few decades. And it could be true that's the case for Russia, too. They got a very bloody nose when they went into Afghanistan as the Soviet army. That lesson is still very resonant for the Russian population. Again, it's very hard to read the runes, especially when you've got such an autocratic country as Russia is. But it's clear that there's been something, not massive perhaps, because he's a very powerful autocrat. And as I say, he's been steadily hobbling his internal opposition. But there have been protests in Russia against this invasion of what is called a brother nation by Russians of all political colors. They regard Russia, they regard Ukraine, I'm afraid, to get it wrong, and regard Ukraine as a brother nation. And that's partly because of a shared communist history, but not entirely. There's a nationalism involved too, and a commonality of outlook in many ways, culturally and linguistically and in many other aspects of shared life and experience. And many people, many Russians woke up yesterday morning with this horrible thought of Russia being a country that invades a neighbor and a neighbor with whom they have so much in common.
And you look at today, as a matter of fact, over 900 people arrested in Moscow, and also St. Petersburg. A couple of thousand people showed up, of all ages and men and women to protest. It's going to be a very interesting look, and this is obviously some sort of turning point in the world. I just you know, with your years of experience, it can go either way.
It's very hard to see which way it will go. That's true. And for the moment, the military impetus is the force that is having most effect. But we'll see. We'll see. Actions like this can't go on forever. At some point, some reassessment will have to take place. And it'll be interesting to see how confident Putin remains in his overall intention of teaching the world a lesson on the broad scheme of things, and more narrowly, if he really wants, and if he achieves the quelling of the Ukrainian spirit of independence. I think it's rather unlikely that he will succeed in that second aim, but that's only my personal view. We'll have to see how things go.
Well, you can find more of David at his website, which is themediabeat.us. He is also a correspondent for Ethics and Belief, and he's great enough to join us every Friday, and we take a look at the media. David, hopefully next week we'll have better things to talk about with the media.
Oh, we'll see.